And I'm getting quite an echo already. Brandy, is that a tech issue?
I'll have to ask IT on that one.
I think it stopped. Okay.
Okay.
Let's hope for the best. Could you go ahead and take roll, Brandy?
Absolutely. Judge Conklin?
Present.
Ms. Fleming? Present. Judge Barton?
Here.
Judge Buckley?
Here.
Judge Cope?
Here.
Judge Fannin?
Here.
Judge Gabe?
Here.
Judge Heinrichs?
Here.
Judge Kelly?
Here.
Judge Margenes? Judge Ryan?
Here.
Judge Thompson?
Here.
Ms. Bartleson?
Here.
Ms. Carter?
Did you say Sherry Carter?
Yes.
Yep, here.
Thank you. Ms. Eberhart?
Here.
Mr. Finke?
Here.
Mr. Landry?
Here.
Mr. Planet? Running late, I believe that was Judge Conklin.
Right, he let us know he'd be late due to another meeting.
Mr. Rule?
Here.
Mr. Taniguchi?
Here.
Mr. Taylor?
Here.
Ms. Turner? Mr. Yamasaki?
Here.
And advisory members, Mr. Wardlaw?
Yes, here.
And Ms. Mueller?
Here.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you all so much for joining us once again. I know every one of us is busy with numerous other tasks, this one being equally important. Thank you for taking the time. I want to welcome you all. We've got some challenging issues before us today, but nothing that I'm confident we cannot resolve today or in the future. So appreciate all of that. Just some bookkeeping matters first. The first one would be the minutes from our July 16th meeting. Those minutes are attached to the materials. I'd invite a motion to approve the minutes.
I move, Judge Barton.
Thank you. And a second?
Judge Kelly seconds.
Moved and seconded that the minutes be approved. Is there any opposition to the approval of the minutes from the July 16th meeting? Hearing no opposition, I'll deem those minutes approved unanimously. Moving next to public comment, folks, we did receive two public comments, both related to item two. Those comments are attached to the materials. They're made available for everybody's review. And with that, as I remind everybody, unfortunately, in the times that we're in, they do not allow for in-person public comments, so there'll be no in-person public comments for today's meeting, and that concludes public comment for today. We've got three issues on the agenda for today. You have all the materials. I'll try to thank people throughout, but each of these issues has required the work of a significant number members of this group and others, and I'll preface everything today with sincere thanks to everybody for their jobs they continue to do beyond their full-time day jobs to help us get our work done. The first action item before us today, it relates to AB 1058, loosely described as child support and family law funding. Unfortunately, like quite a few issues that we've had to deal with, this is an issue of budget reduction rather than budget increase, and that doesn't, I'm not blaming or faulting anybody. That's a practicality of where we are today and a requirement that we address these things. So what you have before you today is provided after careful consideration and hard work from the Family Law and Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee. They've developed an allocation methodology that takes into consideration a $7 million contract reduction for AB 1058 Child Support Program with Department of Child Support Services, DCSS. Their recommendation to us, so again, this is FAMJUV recommending to TICBAC to take to the council, is found on page 7 of your materials, and I'm very thankful that we have two veterans of this issue, both Don Will and Anna Maves with us to present this and answer questions. So I'll turn to both Don and Anna for their presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judge Conklin. Thank you, members of the committee. So just by way of background, Title 40 of the Social Security Act requires that every state have a child support program to establish paternity and child support and enforce child support orders. The federal government provides funding for the state programs. It requires that the state provide a 34% match, or 34% of the funding, and then the feds will provide the 66% of the match. In California, the Department of Child Support Services administers California's child support program and contracts with the Judicial Council biannually to provide funding. Unfortunately, the funding for the program has been flat since 2008. The current funding for the Child Support Commissioner Program is about $31.5 million. And for the Family Law Facilitator funding, it's about $10.7 million. So the commissioners receive about 75% of the funding for the program, and the Family Law Facilitators receive about 25% of the funding for the program. This is funds that are completely reimbursable. These are both the federal and state funds. We also have additional funds that were made available back in 2008 when the program was previously cut. We call these federal drawdown funds. So there's an additional about $8.5 million that's made available if the court wants to replace the state matching fund. So if the court puts in the one-third funding, it can draw down the additional about $8.5 million from the feds. And on the facilitator side, if the courts want to put in about $1.5 million, they can draw down about $3 million from the feds. So those funds will still be available. The council annually allocates those based on courts asking to participate in that program and having those funds available. So also by way of reminder, the funding for the Child Support Commissioner side of the program is allocated using a workload-based funding methodology that was adopted by the Judicial Council in January of 2019. This methodology implements changes in two-year increments to align the funding based on workload. The funding for the Family Law Facilitator side of the program still uses a historical funding methodology with a new workload-based methodology to be implemented for fiscal 21-22. So as Judge Conklin mentioned, unfortunately, we were notified by the Department of Child Support Services that the Judicial Council's AB 1058 program would receive a budget reduction in state funding of about $2.38 million, which also results then in the loss of the federal matching dollars of about $4.5 million, creating a total budget reduction for this fiscal year of $7 million. There is potentially good news. The new state budget also has triggers that would restore funding to prior levels in the event that $14 billion in federal funds is received by October 15th. So any budget reduction for this fiscal year would be restored if those federal dollars are received. So the $7 million equates to about a 16.5% budget reduction for this fiscal year. So in an attempt to determine the operational impacts of this funding reduction, we met with the Court Executive Advisory Committee's AB 1058 subcommittee to find out what, if they had any recommendations they would like to make to the Family and Juvenile Law Advisory Committee and the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee on operational impacts and how to implement these kind of budget reductions. Despite the funding reductions, the subcommittee still noted the importance of still moving towards equity based on workload and the desire that any reduction methodology parallel the recent Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee recommendations to the council on the reduction of trial court funds. They also recognize that the AB 1058 program is a statutorily mandated program and that Title 40 cases must be heard by the AB 1058 Child Support Commissioner and that a family law facilitator be available in every court. So they requested that there be some consideration for the smallest courts, the Cluster 1 courts, to ensure that courts can comply with the statutory mandate. They recognize the need for kind of all courts to accept some of these reductions, but thought that a 50% of the statewide percentage would be more palatable for the smallest courts. The Family and Juvenile Law Advisory Committee is also charged with making recommendations to this committee on funding methodologies, and FAMJUVE had an extensive discussion and weighed a number of options, but ultimately agreed with the recommendation of the SEAC subcommittee, with one exception that they thought that the 1% in the band should be uniformly applied instead of any scaling. So I'm going to turn it over to Don Will to kind of walk through the models that were developed and explain exactly what the recommendation is.
Thanks very much, Don.
Thanks, Anna. As Anna noted, when the SEAC subcommittee met for the first time, they brainstormed several reduction models, which we then presented at a subsequent email exchange. There were 9 scenarios in total, and they really worked with 2 different variables. The first variable was, in the case of the child support commissioners that have a workload needs-based funding allocation model, we were able to do the banded methodology based on the need met, and so the subcommittee looked at no banded methodology. Commissioners get the full pro rata cut, counties take it across the board, a 2% on either side of the median and a 3% on either side of the median. In addition, it discussed the cluster one courts and asked to see those as taking their full share of the pro rata reduction, taking half a share of the pro rata reduction, so instead of 16%, 8%, and then taking a no reduction at all. And they looked at all of those, and as Anna says, landed on recommending that for both facilitators and commissioners, the cluster one courts take half of the reduction, and for the commissioners, they take the reduction be allocated in a 2% band, which worked out to be about 17.8% above the band, 16.8% in the band, and 15.8% below the band. And finally asked to scale the lower end of the band. Those recommendations we relayed to the Family and Juvenile Law Advisory Committee along with all of the scenarios, and those are linked in the JC report as part of the FAMJUVE meeting attachments. That group settled on the same recommendation as the SEAC subcommittee, with the exception of not scaling the lower band, but again to have the cluster one courts take half of the overall reduction, the family law facilitators take pro rata across the courts other than the cluster one courts because we don't have a workload methodology yet for them, and the child support commissioners take the 4%, 2% above and 2% below the state average NEEP. We're not able to do the bottom end of the scaling in time to post it for this meeting. However, I can give you we have done it since then. The courts below the band who would be scaled between 15.8 and 16.8% of a reduction, roughly there's 8 courts. Their total reduction amounts to about $2 million. The amount of the reduction that comes into play for the scaling is about $135,000, and applying the same calculation that was used to scale the reduction band, the lowest reduction band in the trust fund report, They would range from around close to the 16.8 reduction down to about 16.4%. I know that's a lot. I'm sorry we did not have the report available, but that is what would happen when we apply the scaling at the low end. So what you see in attachment A1 and A2 and attachment B are the Family and Juvenile Law Advisory Committee recommendations. And then attachment C is taking the step of applying those recommendations to the request to approve the allocations for the council. So we have the reduction recommendations, but we also have this final recommendation for the council to approve the full amounts so that then we can implement the AB 1058 contracts. Thanks.
So we'll take questions. And Dawn, as I understand it, the ultimate recommendation does not include scaling, correct?
It does not from the Family and Juvenile Law Advisory Committee, no.
Okay, thank you so much. So I'll open this up for questions or a motion concerning the recommendation as set forth on page 7.
Bartleson moves for approval as presented.
Moved. Is there a second?
Margin of seconds.
Okay, so it's been moved and seconded that the recommendation at page 7 of the materials be approved by this committee. And again, not to stifle in any way discussion, I want to make sure that now that it's been moved and seconded, if anybody like to ask any questions or any discussion on this recommendation.
A question?
Was there a question?
A question from Neil Taniguchi.
Go ahead, Neil.
So the budget reduction from state DCSS was for the state match. Is that correct? I guess is that for Dawn and Anna?
Yeah, so the DCSS received a reduction in state funding that results in losing the federal matching funds. So it's a $2.38 million reduction, but a total loss of $7 million since we also lose the federal matching funds.
So for those courts that have done the option of the federal drawdown, does it affect them as the same as well?
So we the council allocates the what we call the base funds, which is the state and federal 100% reimbursable funds. According to the funding methodology, there are still the federal drawdown funds that will continue to be available to courts. And those are allocated based on a questionnaire that's sent to courts where courts can opt in if they have those matching or if they have those funds available to draw down those federal matching dollars.
So under these reductions, then their drawdown is going to reduce as well?
No, the drawdown will remain the same. It's the same amount.
I think that's it.
Thanks, Neil. Any other questions for Dawn or Anna? All right, it's been moved and seconded that the recommendation at page 7 of the materials be approved. Unless I hear any further requests, questions, or requests for discussion, is there any opposition to the recommendation as set forth at page 7 of the materials concerning item 1? Paused, I've waited, I hear no opposition, therefore I'll deem the recommendation at page 7 unanimously approved by TICPAC. Don and Anna, thank you so much. And if anybody from FAMJUV is listening in, thank you as well. Like any other issues, unfortunately, with reductions, these are always struggles, and we appreciate your efforts to bring to us, I wish I could say a good resolution, but it's at least an effective resolution, and I appreciate that.
Thank you, Judge Cochran.
Thank you. Okay, so now we're going to move to action item number 2 on our agenda. This is the 2020-2021 Court Interpreter one-time allocation methodology and development of a workload-based allocation methodology for the next fiscal year. We did receive 2 public comments for this, as I noted at the beginning of our meeting today. Those public comments are included in your material for review. We do appreciate the folks who submitted those comments. Believe me, they have been read and considered. So to frame our discussion for today, I'm going to turn it over in just a minute to Cottrell and to the members of a working group. But the focus today is the one-time allocation methodology for our current appropriation related to the court interpreter program. This will provide more time, and as again I say, this is a one-time allocation. It's in many parts. It'll provide more time for the ad hoc working group to develop a workload-based allocation methodology for future use. Within that discussion, they're going to use all the tools they have. We recognize, and perhaps it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyways, the importance of the court interpreters to the everyday functioning of the court. And this has nothing to do with any perspective that does not exist, by the way, that the court interpreters are not a crucial part of our court. It just deals with the reality of budget cuts and trying to keep those court interpreters as effective as possible. This will also help us to leverage tech solutions for the to assist courts and to assist those interpreters in providing information or providing their services to the court. I'm going to ask first for Cottrell to give us a brief overview of the allocation methodology and recommendation, and then we have with us David Yamasaki, Sherry Carter, Kim Turner. Mike Planet is trying to come on, but he was delayed by a meeting in his court. But I want to thank each of them. There's been a lot of work going on behind the scenes on this, and it is, as with all our other tasks, challenging. And I thank them all so much for the time they put in. The ultimate recommendation, folks, that we'll be considering is at page 23 of the materials. So, Cottrell, I'll turn to you. Are you with us?
I am. Good afternoon.
Great. For your summary first, and then, David, I'd invite you, as I believe the chair and the other members of the working group, to provide comments. Cottrell?
Sure. Item two of today's agenda is the consideration of a recommendation from the Ad Hoc Interpreter Subcommittee for a 2021 allocation methodology. This is for the Court Interpreter Program, and the intent is to not exceed the 2020 Budget Act appropriation in the amount of $130.4 million. On June 11th of 2020, TICPAC approved a recommendation from the Funding Methodology Subcommittee to defer actions to reduce the Court Interpreter Program reimbursement to trial courts until the Ad Hoc Interpreter Subcommittee had sufficient time to develop an allocation reduction methodology that addresses shortfalls for 2021 and 2021-22. The Ad Hoc Interpreter Subcommittee has developed an allocation methodology recommendation specifically for 2021. This one-time approach, as Judge Conklin mentioned, identifies each court's need based on the 1920 Schedule 7A salary and benefit averages, and as well as the actual 18-19 contractor expenditures. It allocates dollars on a pro rata basis up to the appropriation amount. This approach, assuming council approval, would replace the current reimbursement process as well as the year-end true-up process, and would provide courts with timely allocation information for planning purposes. Today's recommendation is for TICPAC to approve for consideration by council at its September business meeting the one-time 2021 allocation methodology by court as outlined in attachment 2B, while the Ad Hoc Interpreter Subcommittee continues development of a workload-based allocation methodology recommendation for implementation beginning in fiscal year 21-22. That concludes my summary, Judge Conklin, and we can open it for discussion or questions.
Great. Thanks, Cottrell. David, I'll turn it over to you and your group to see if there's anything else you'd like to add.
Yes, thank you very much, Judge Conklin, and certainly thank you to the other members of this ad hoc working group that was tasked with presenting to this body a balanced budget, but also a recommended approach to go forward with how we were going to be dealing with what appears to be an ongoing challenge in operating in a balanced budget. This year, the materials show that we have about $11.5 million shortfall between the appropriation level and the expenditure level. That problem significantly grows in the following year. So what we were trying to do is submit recommendations based on some data that we would have available to us, and move us in the direction of an allocation model. All of us have been providing interpreters from one pot of funding, and that is the program 4545,
account, and all of us unfortunately draw from the same pot, and that is the same pot of funding that drives a lot of the hiring slash usage that we have, and oftentimes we are challenged by knowing what is left, and that's partly the reason that we are finding ourselves in a situation today where things are pretty significantly out of balance. In our effort to try to come up with a recommendation, one of the things that we wanted to do was look at data. The challenge in that area was, while we may have some very good information concerning staff interpreters, we draw that information from the 7A report. The other area where we're severely challenged is the use of interpreters and how much is spent on contract interpreters. Is very difficult to ascertain how many actual interpreters are used in a given year. What makes it more complicated is the fact that not everybody, not all of the courts provide information in the same way in which contract interpreters are used. So we were challenged by only having the dollar amount, but not necessarily the number of interpreters that were used. I think it's incumbent upon us to land in a methodology that not only recognizes use of interpreters, both staff and independent contractors, but also doing it in a way that we can have reliable information and courts providing that information on a consistent basis so that we can look at the same data and assess what our interpreter needs are going forward. But until that happens, the effort that we were trying to move forward was basing it on very specific criteria, and let me explain what that involves. Much like the funding methodology that was created for the allocation of funds to each of the trial courts, we wanted to get an assessment of the average cost of interpreters and take into consideration cost of living indexes by each county. And I think this is what we did in this first round for this fiscal year, by taking the average cost of interpreters, staff interpreters, and calculating a local index against that. We also took historical information concerning independent contractor usage and distributed it in a way that recognized the percentage of the whole that each court uses, and coupling that with the staff cost, what we have before you is a recommendation that is balanced, but also leaves the discretion within each court into how to use those dollars to provide interpreter services. There is no recommendation that is being expressed that identifies how interpreters are going to be used. It's merely the dollar amount. And I think it's fair to say that we looked at past history on how many interpreters were hired by each court. We looked at how much money each court spent on independent contractors, and we basically fitted into the allocation or the appropriation that's been afforded to us. Going forward, our hope is that we can further identify very specific information that will complement the data that is available on the 7A so that we can more appropriately recognize interpreter use by each court. One of the significant challenges that we have is that workload, when I say workload, I'm specifically talking about filings, doesn't necessarily detail how many interpreters a court is going to be using or need. Some of it relies on other variables, maybe geography, a population, that may be a factor. But at this point, it's too early to say specifically what details we will be landing on in terms of some of the criteria for making recommendations going forward. But at this point, know that the recommendation that the ad hoc committee is making today comes from the notion that it's a one-time proposal, and that we took the data that was reliable today to fold into the recommendation. And I think that it gives all of us a operating budget in which to try to, manage our operations accordingly. So that's the information that and the approach that we took taken with this ad hoc working group. And I'll defer to any other members of the ad hoc working group who participated in the discussion that we undertook.
David, thank you so much. And Sherry, Kim, I don't think Mike's joined us yet, but anything you want to add?
So this is Kim, and I'm sorry, my camera, I can't have both the camera and the audio going. I get the fritz out on my computer. So you'll hear my mellifluous tones, but you will not see my shining face today. So I just wanted to add that, the working group on a very short timeline really struggled with the fact that we are essentially going from what has been a longstanding reimbursement-based program to sort of transitioning to an allocation-based program. And the reasons for that are known to all of us. So, for many, many years, the State Interpreter Fund did enjoy a surplus that rolled over from year to year to year. But about four or five years ago, that surplus became depleted as courts rightfully moved into many other case types and tried to provide language access services across the board and to any LEP member, an LEP individual who came to the court. So it put quite a strain on the funding that was available in the fund. And the last several years, the Trial Court Trust Fund has actually backfilled this fund with any shortfall that we have. Well, now we're in a very different economic climate. The Trial Court Trust Fund cannot, cannot continue to bail out the Interpreter Fund. And one of the things that we're struggling with, this one first year proposal looked at data that was available, but even we would say it is not, the quality of the data is not all that we would like it to be. So in the subsequent years, we're hoping to really use workload data, and the best place to get that is not, as David so eloquently stated, from filings, but it's from the data that's reported through the CIDCS portal. Now, we have challenges there because not every court is using the portal and reporting up their data through the portal. And so we're going to have further conversation about how we capture all of the data for the courts that are, for all 58 courts that are using interpreter services, so that it lands in one repository that we're then able to take a look at. But I just wanted to add that, these are tough times, and, this meeting is all about hearing about reductions in 1058 and now reductions in the interpreter fund. That is not lost on any of us. We are court executives. We're all struggling with the same thing, but we had to come up with a way to, make the two ends of the string meet this year. And this was the best, we thought, approach to doing so. So,
Kim, thanks so much. Any other comments from any members of the working group? All right, any questions for anybody, the working group or Cottrell on this recommendation? I truly appreciate the framework that you've set on this. It's essentially two parts. It's a one-time allocation methodology for this fiscal year, 2021. And then the ad hoc working group will continue, as they have been, their hard work in a workload-based allocation methodology for future years through the lens of the struggles that we're currently in. Nancy, did I see that you had a hand up and you want to ask a question?
That is me. I do. I actually have a multi-part question, but I first wanted to compliment the working group on a tough task and doing the best they could to come up with a methodology that, considered all aspects of what we need to do for the interpreter fund. And this has been something that's been a concern for quite some time. So kudos to them for the hard work. My questions are, again, multi-part. And the first was, what was the reasoning behind going with an average statewide salary in column B and then using actual of per diem costs in column G, and then on the average in column B, how was that calculated? Because, and I can only speak from a local standpoint, but I can't come to that average based on the salary figures that I have here, salary and benefits. So just more of a question than anything else.
Cottrell, you want to jump in on the chart itself?
Sure. So regarding salaries and benefits, that portion was taken from the Schedule 7A for fiscal year 1920. It took the average salary and benefits for each position for field positions. And then, so for instance, let's say there were 20 court interpreter supervisors and then 20 interpreter coordinators. The average of each of those groups is how you get to the average for the average salary and benefits for each individual court in today's materials. I'm not sure if that was clear, Nancy, but if not, I can restate or further elaborate.
But just using an example, if I had a coordinator making 100,000, an interpreter mm-hmm. making 50,000, or 47 interpreters making 50,000, you would take the 50 and the 100 and take the average of that.
Correct.
It wouldn't be necessarily the 50 interpreters and the one coordinator mixed together into 51.
Exactly.
Okay.
Did you have more of your multi-part question, Nancy?
Only the reasoning behind taking the statewide average for our actual employees and taking the per diem actual cost for the contractors. What was the decision making behind that?
Well, essentially there we were trying to back into the need. Historically, salaries and benefits have accounted for roughly 75% of total expenditures for the court interpreter program. And being that we know what the appropriation is, and we know with that math or that methodology how we would get to the contractor need, that's why we went with that. Also, I spoke with someone earlier this morning about this very question, and we would have also used more current data, but 18-19 is the most complete fiscal year that we have. That's why this is a one-time thing, because as Kim Turner mentioned earlier, we would also like to base this on the data available in CIDCS. So we were working within certain parameters, certain limitations, and this was the most accurate and best available data to get us to this point.
Cottrell, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Sure.
And Nancy, this is Kim again. I would just also add for everyone, I think that we are entering kind of a new era, at least for the foreseeable future, in terms of fiscal austerity. And a couple of the regions 3 and 4, have the ability to use VRI. And this may be the perfect opportunity. And many of us are still dealing with COVID-related, remote interpreting practices. So this is the perfect time to really, I think, try to capitalize on the use of technology in this area, so that we can stretch those dollars a little further. Regions 1 and 2 do not currently have VRI ability, and they may have language in their contracts that permits them to meet and confer on it, as we do in Region 2, but that meet and confer has not yet occurred. I don't know what the status is in Region 1, but I know that this is certainly putting, I think, more sharp focus on how we can use our interpreters more efficiently than driving or flying them up for short appearances from all four points of California. So these are things that I think we're going to have to be thinking about as we try to get those dollars to go further.
David, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I did actually. So I know that there is, there's been a lot of discussion as it relates to some of the challenges that we have as a branch. This body is not making any recommendation other than a fiscal one on how courts would be utilizing interpreters. We obviously, as Kim mentioned earlier, this is a whole new ball game. But what we're trying to do is just make a proposal that balances the budget and leaves entirely the discretion on how interpreters are used based on a local court's practices and priorities. So I just want to make sure that folks are aware that this is purely a recommendation on the allocation of the funding, not on the use.
Excellent.
Thanks for clarifying that, David. Yeah, this is Kim again. We're not in any way prescripting that courts ought to be doing practicing in any way in particular. We're simply making a fiscal recommendation.
And it seems to me what you're doing is what we've all tried to do, and that is give the courts the ability to plan and prepare. What they do is up to them, but this gives them the borders of their funding, and how they then what they do with that is their discretion.
Yes.
Any other questions or thoughts on this issue? And if not, I'd invite a motion
Judge Conklin? Judge
I'm
Conklin,
sorry.
I'm sorry, Chris Rule, can I ask one more question on this?
Of course, Chris.
I want to make sure I completely understand the chart, because columns B and C do are titled statewide averages, but I'm understanding from Cottrell that the actual numbers for each court in those columns are sort of the average of that court's 7As for the interpreter staff and benefits?
That is correct. Yes, that is correct.
Yeah, so Chris, this is Brandy. The statewide average reference is for really the totals at the bottom, because those totals average the averages per the court and represent what the statewide salary and benefits averages are.
Okay, so then that's why the BLS adjustment was applied to each court individual salary, right?
It was, yes. No, hold on, sorry, stay with me here. No, so then the BLS salary adjustment, Chris, it's the total average statewide salary of $73,772 multiplied then for each port by their individual BLS.
Okay, good. Thank you for that clarification. That's
no problem. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. And I see Mike Planet has joined us. Mike is part of this as well. Thanks, Mike. So, any further questions?
I have a question on this. This is Sean Landry.
Go ahead, Sean.
Just so I understand the mechanics of it. So, a court then would receive up to a certain allocation amount, and then how would that, I guess, mechanically work? Once we get to that amount, we'll receive some sort of. If we go over the amount, we're reduced by that allocation. Is that, how would that work? I guess I'm not clear. Once we hit the allocation mark, how would that work after that?
Judge, I can speak to that.
Thanks.
Yeah, so one of the things, just as we deal with all of our allocation methodologies, is we get a set dollar amount. If a court finds itself exceeding the allocation, and interpreter needs continue. So let's say middle of June, your court exceeds the allocation, then the court would not be receiving any reimbursement for additional expenses. If a court has reserves to use in that area, then that's the anticipated remedy that a court would be looking at to cover the interpreter cost needs. Clearly, there is no more money left in 4545 beyond the 130. So that's the anticipated approach until we can come up with a different methodology going into next year. But for this fiscal year, the recommendation is that it not exceed that budgeted amount. And we basically are distributing it in its entirety, or the recommendation is this, to distribute to each court in its entirety. And with the understanding that any expenses in excess of that would be the responsibility of a local court.
Go ahead.
I think there's another question.
Yeah, this is Kim. I have a question. Was there any discussion about if a court underspends as far as those funds being earmarked and the court's allowed to roll them over, or is if they're not spent, are we giving it back to be reallocated?
We did not talk about it in great detail, but keep in mind, Program 4545 funding is specifically earmarked, and so it cannot be used for another purpose. I think there may be an opportunity to, you know, take a look at how we would deal with the surplus aspect of it, but quite honestly, the distance between the expenditure level and the funding level, we were not contemplating a surplus, but perhaps something that we would be looking at if the chair of TICBAC advises us to do so.
Nancy, I saw your hand up. Thanks, David.
Conklin, I'm sorry, I just have a follow-up on my previous questions. As I'm looking at it, I'm still not clear on column B. And using the statewide averages, was there a reason why we couldn't use the actual salary and benefits in column B and C, and we decided to go with average?
Cottrell?
I'm looking now.
I think, this is Brandy, while you guys are looking, I'll chime in. Nancy, a lot of this also is trying to take into consideration that there are variables between regions without actually having all of the data and opportunity to dig in further for the current year. Some people pay more or less for staff and for contractors for various reasons. Contractors, as we talked about before, there's just a lot more work to do in gathering data. So at least for staff, it was what is the best way? But what if we look at everyone as an average, find that statewide rate, but then take into consideration other BLS adjustments and make those factors accordingly. So it was just an approach to try to find a fair way of distributing the dollars for the current year.
And I don't mean to speak for the working group at all, but I think this exemplifies the two parts. This is they're trying to do their best for this fiscal year that we're already into, 2021. If there's perhaps suggestions or modifications as they move forward, I'd invite everybody to share that with the working group. That's the purpose of a working group, is to take something, run with it, and then modify it and make it better as it goes. So these are very effective questions that perhaps can be addressed as the working group moves forward for its allocation methodology recommendations for upcoming years.
And this is Judge Heinrichs again. I actually just wanted to ask the question, and I'm not speaking against it in any way. I just wanted to ask it and have it be mindful as we move forward. So thanks.
Judge Conklin, Chris Rule, can I ask one more question?
Of course.
And partly because this is our first effort to move from a reimbursement based to allocation based methodology for this funding, might we want to contemplate some kind of a mid-year review or adjustment milestone, similar to what we do with other allocated funds, some of the like AB 1058, in case some kind of mid-year adjustment might be needed based on actual experience in particular courts?
David?
Yeah, so that's a very good point, Chris. I know that we've tackled this sort of situation kind of in similar fashion. The challenge that we have operationally, and I know you're acutely aware, is that making changes to help us operate within a particular budget takes a great deal of work. It takes a great deal of work not only in changing calendaring. Many of the cases that we have are scheduled months out in advance. And so it really gives us an opportunity to put things into place and continue refinements over time so that we can fall within a particular budget. At the end of the day, I don't know that anybody is really enthusiastic about the funding level because of the previous practices that have been in place in using interpreters, but we have a budget that is woefully different from what our spending activities have been. And so this is an opportunity for us to just do a one-time recommendation, put certain things in place as courts deem appropriate to deal with the demands that we have with respect to interpreters. And I quite honestly don't know that we would have enough money to go back and reassess. It's taken us months and months to even get to this point. And I think that at this point, the best approach is to simply distribute the money in a way that everybody has an idea for the entire year, what they're looking at, and implement whatever practices and changes they need to ensure that they too fall within a balanced budget as well.
Okay, yeah, thank you, David.
Add, Chris, this is Kim. I think unlike 1058 funds and some other places where we could do a mid-year reallocation, those funds are typically expended, AB 1058, for example, is typically expended in a fairly even, predictable way throughout the year, whereas I think interpreter funds are not nearly as predictable. So you could have, for example, a small court, a rural court, go through the first half of the year and not spend very much of the per diem. You know, some of them don't even have employees. So let's say they work on per diem employees only, not spend much on that. And then in the second half of the year, after the mid-year reallocation process has happened, have a four defendant,
non-English speaker trial where they're going to then, you know, use all of the money that they have. So I think the concern is that we don't have as much predictability in the way those funds are spent, especially, I mean, on the larger scale, the larger courts have a probably more even usage of the funds throughout the year, but the small rural courts, really, it's case driven. And you know, sometimes you have a year where you don't use very much, and other times you would be running out of money. So I think it would be hard to do that. I'm hoping that we can all live with this first year proposal that we are making to the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee, with the understanding that we know it's imperfect, that we want to go further, we want to dig deeper and try to come up with a better, more equitable way to do this program, you know, in the years forward.
Thanks, Kim. Nancy, you had your hand up. And again, I'm just echoing what David and Kim and others have said. Keep in mind, folks, this is a model being built. We've got this first year allocation methodology, and then we're going to move forward. So these questions are all great. I think these are very effective factors for the committee, the working group, to consider as they work out the allocation methodology moving forward, as can be used, and this year can be used as a model for that. Nancy, I'm sorry, did you have another question?
Well, and I think I forgot to lower my hand, but since I was given the floor for a second, just to again compliment the working group on the amount of work done in such a short amount of time, and knowing that it's not the easiest thing to do. So thank you to all of you.
Great. Any other questions for any members presenting or for Cottrell? And if not, I'd invite a motion concerning the recommendation as set forth on page 23 of your materials.
Judge Conklin, this is David. I would move approval of the recommendation by the ad hoc committee or working
David,
group.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Judge Thompson will second.
Moved and seconded that the recommendation is set forth on page 23 of the materials be approved and presented to the council. Any further discussion on this issue?
Judge Conklin, yes. If you don't mind, John Wardlaw, I just want to point out that I do think it makes sense for us to track the expenditures by courts on this. As Mr. Yamasaki has correctly articulated, this is a funding conversation. The service delivery is another piece of this. And to the extent that we are seeing costs in going in a direction that exceeds our allocation, there are times within the year that we have an opportunity to talk to the governor and the legislature about the funding needs. And so should we need a current year adjustment, there is still an opportunity for that conversation. So I would encourage a continuance of cost tracking, expenditure tracking, for potential for more discussion, which is, I realize, separate from the allocation discussion that you guys are having now, but tracking is important. And as we all know, we must provide for access to populations that need assistance with regard to interpreting. So again, would encourage cost tracking so that we can have a conversation with the administration and the legislature should it be necessary.
Yeah, that's a good point, John. And I don't think for a moment anybody on this committee has failed to recognize the significance of court interpreters to the courts. This is not what this discussion is about. This discussion is about trying to responsibly use the funds we have to provide for and enhance those services. But John, your point is a great one. And if I hope I'm understanding it correctly, court should plan to have the money they have. And that's what this allocation is about. If using current information from the courts, as John notes, can help us get more, all the better. But you can't count on that. And I think I saw Mike plant his hand up. Mike?
Yeah, I just want to make the comment that this is going to be a weird year to track these kinds of expenses. I mean, to say the least, right? I mean, since July 1st, I've had two jury trials. None have involved interpreters. By this point, we would have had scads of jury trials requiring interpreters and court hearings. And where we've had some interpreters in prelims, they've been appearing by Zoom or online. So we've avoided travel expenses. So we're having a hell of a time trying to predict what and then trying to anticipate when the so-called wave of cases is going to come our way, what we're going to be able to handle. So we're having just a really incredibly difficult time trying to figure out what this new what this year is going to be like. And so I think I'm also concerned that we may face a situation where our expenditures this year are just down because of the cramp, the crimps that have been put in our business models here. Dare I say, there's the possibility that there will be some unexpended funds in interpreter year left over. And to use this year as a kind of a model year to project future budgeting is going to be another challenge, John Wardlaw, that we're going to have to deal with, because this year is going to be such an aberration. But so just some observation thoughts as we've kicked around trying to figure out how we're going to deal with these this underfunded budget line of ours relative to previous years.
If anybody heard my laughter, it was simply meant to emphasize Mike Planet's comment that this has been a weird year, to say the least. So before I call for a vote, any other questions, comments on this pending motion? All right, hearing none, is there any opposition to the recommendation as set forth on page 23 of the materials? I hear no opposition, therefore I'll deem the recommendation as set forth on page 23 unanimously approved. Thank you all so much, both members of the working group, Cottrell, and everybody on this committee that's thoughtfully pondered this, asked very effective questions as this working group moves forward to its task for next year, and none of you are off the hook. The working group remains as set. So, David, I see your appreciative smile. We appreciate all the work you folks are doing. Okay, so we have one more action item on our agenda today, folks. That relates to the $50 million allocation for COVID workload backlog. I'm going to present on this along with Rebecca and others. In this presentation, I want to give you a quick review of how we got here and then what I anticipate to be the next steps. This committee has worked diligently, responsibly, and I think very effectively in developing allocation methodologies as we've moved through our years, and we were faced with that again this year, specifically two allocation methodologies, both unfortunately for reduced funding that was nobody's fault but COVID, and that was of approximately $168 million. And then an allocation methodology to the trial courts. Thankfully, and we do appreciate once again the governor and the legislature, DOF and others, and the work of Martin and the chief and everybody in accomplishing a $50 million allocation to the trial courts to address COVID workload backlog. After a lot of work, this committee came up with allocation methodologies related to both those issues. As chair of TICPAC, I presented those to the council at its recent meeting on July 24th, the council unanimously approved the methodology related to the recommendation of the $168 million reduction. The council also considered our committee's recommendation about the $50 million COVID workload backlog allocation. In summary, the council unanimously approved the allocation of the first $25 million on the pro rata methodology recommended by this group. Upon consideration, however, and valid consideration, the council sent further recommendations back to us about allocating the remainder of that funding, the $25 million that's left, as well as defining terms to show past, present, and future need related to COVID workload backlog. They sent that back to us. So the next steps for this committee are as follows. Again, this is another very important issue. We've tackled complex issues in the past. This is no less of a complex issue that is only exacerbated by the crisis that we're currently undergoing. As we also have learned, for good reason, there are numerous entities who are paying close attention to our action on this issue. Again, I emphasize for good reason. We need to be able to show, as we have in the past, that the trial courts continuously strive to show, and that we can show that this $50 million is needed and has been and will be used for the purpose intended. That is, the impact of the COVID-19 environment that has had on our trial courts as a branch, and what the $50 million will do and can do for the recovery reduction in backlogs from this pandemic for those courts and all of our constituents, which we always strive to make sure we provide the best services possible. While time is of the essence for these next steps and for the actions of this group, we have learned in the past that the need to be expedient should not outweigh the need to develop a methodology that is effective, transparent, and trustworthy. That time will allow folks also to be heard about their thoughts related to the proposed allocation methodology. For those reasons, and in consultation with Vice Chair Rebecca Fleming, who I need to thank for her tireless efforts in this as well, among others, as Chair of TICBEC, I'm proposing that a small working group be formed to develop an allocation method, a recommendation concerning an allocation methodology for the remaining $25 million, as well as to define the factors for the courts to use to show both past, present use of the $25 million already allocated and a future need related to the COVID workload backlog. So that the framework of that is the four-part motion that the council approved coming back to us. That four-part motion is set forth in your materials, and it's as follows concerning the $50 million allocation. Of the $50 million appropriated to the judicial branch for trial court COVID-19 related backlogs, the council has again allocated the $25 million immediately using the pro rata methodology. The motion approved at the council then requires that TICBEC develop a more precise definition and practices for documenting and reporting the COVID-19 related backlogs, and then report those recommendations to the council prior to the distribution of the second $25 million. Third, the TICBEC will gather from trial courts data related to how trial courts spent the first $25 million and report that data back to the council prior to any further allocation. And finally, TICBEC will develop in consultation with JBBC, the Judicial Branch Budget Committee headed by Judge Rubin, recommendations for allocating the remaining $25 million on a data and needs basis. And TICBEC will report that to the council. As soon as the working group completes its work, I would propose that the matter then immediately come back to TICBEC either at our next scheduled meeting or, if appropriate and possible, prior to the next scheduled meeting at a special meeting, after consultation with JCTC, to send that recommendation to TICBEC for approval and then to the council. So I'm going to turn to Rebecca for her thoughts on this and any recommendations concerning what I'm inviting to be the motion to form the working group. Rebecca?
Thank you, Judge Conklin. I think everybody can hear me, right? Somebody nod. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay, this is a very complex issue, and not only because of the ongoing nature of the COVID environment that we're in, but because of our unique needs by court. I know I speak for many in expressing my thanks to you, Judge Conklin, and to the Judicial Council members for distributing the first half of the COVID funding, which I believe actually is going to be distributed at the end of this week. Brandy, can you confirm that for me?
It's Friday. I've confirmed that through Brandy, yes, so all the courts... Everybody
okay.
gets their first half of the $25 million day after tomorrow.
Yes, thank you. I know it will allow many courts to start addressing their needs, but because of the complexity, I've been reaching out to a number of the courts and getting their feedback on the direction from the Judicial Council members and their decision. First, I want to thank you to everybody who took the time to talk with me, and I apologize if I haven't actually spoken with you individually. I know several of you chatting in meetings where you're checking and touching base on where things are at with COVID anyway. And so I've kind of used those forums as well to gather some information. And so that being said, what I'd like to do is, I know there's a few of you who have some input from those other courts. I'd like to actually, before we take the motion, Judge, I'd like to actually have those execs share out some of their comments and the input from the courts. And these are courts that are on this committee and from around the state that are not on this committee. I wanted to try and solicit as much input as possible. And so if I might, I'd like to actually have David start and share any input that he might have, either from his own comments or from those who have been shared by others.
Yeah, thanks very much, Rebecca and Judge Conklin. One of the things that I'm really proud of is the work that the TICBEC advisory committee undertakes in order to make a recommendation to the Judicial Council I think that our discussions that have taken place with respect to the proposed methodology for distributing this money was well thought out. We had a very, very hearty discussion on this. And we thought, I mean, I thought the conversation was good and the details were very soundly presented. But where we do come up short, I think we rely on the Judicial Council to tell us, based on information that they know, we need to provide additional information and detail and the methodology, and that's what we're hearing. And I think it's great to give us an opportunity to provide the information that they feel is necessary to take action on the second half of the money. I'm also very pleased to hear that the work of this ad hoc working group is something that's going to be assembled very quickly. And the reason why I say that is that many of us had built our budgets based on what we may be seeing out of the COVID backlog funding, and it's very desperately needed, especially here in Orange. I'm sure it's the same in all of the other courts, because not only did we sustain a $13 million reduction to our budget, we've also sustained very significant reductions in the revenues that have basically been reduced by the fact that we've been closed. And the fact that we're closed doesn't mean that the workload has gone away. It's simply being pushed out into the future. So we are going to be dealing with very significant backlogs that are upon us because we're opening our doors more and more, much like everybody else is. And those dollars are going to be very, very helpful to not only allow us to direct resources into specific areas, but also shore up some of the losses in local revenue that we have sustained. And yeah, it's local revenues, and part of it is offsetting local costs. But, you know, it's part of the bottom line that we operate under day in and day out. And when we build our budgets, we take into consideration the allocations, we take into consideration earmarked funding, local funding. And so all of these things fall into one pot that we draw from to keep our operations afloat. And the additional money that we're going to be receiving from the first allocation going out this week is going to be very, very well received. We're hoping that we can assemble recommendations to this body. If I'm given the opportunity to participate on that ad hoc group, that we can quickly make the recommendation to the Judicial Council on how to deal with the second half of the COVID backlog funding. So we're very, very desperate at this point to get whatever remedy that we can in the reduction in budget in our budgets, as well as the local revenues, because all of it ties into one thing, and that's allowing us to conduct business as we're supposed to be doing. And that backlog is not getting any smaller. It's growing. And I know that once the doors open, filings are going to be back up to what they were before. And I'm very excited and enthusiastic that we can get sorted on whatever we can on submitting our recommendations to this body.
Thank you, David. Oh, I'm sorry, Judge Conklin, go ahead.
No, I was just going to thank David. I shouldn't have stepped on you. Go ahead, Rebecca.
Oh, you're fine. Yeah, this is your show.
Oh, no, it's everybody's.
Thank you, David. Sherry, did you have some comments you wanted to share?
You know, I do. I've had the opportunity to talk with a few other CEOs, and so I'm going to try to express some of the views I've heard, plus as well as my own. I think most of you know that I very strongly feel that we are stronger as one judicial branch of government than we are as 58 individual counties. And that's always been my approach to any funding allocation, and that would include allocation reductions, as many of you know as well. But this is kind of a unique set of circumstances around COVID backlogs. And while I think we really need to stay together as one branch, and I am always going to underscore the fact that we need to stay together as one branch, with this particular situation, I think it's important that we define the issues, the problems, how it impacts costs, starting at the branch level. But we also need to respect and understand the fact that there will always be differences in each county based on unique COVID-related issues like infection rates, employee and judicial impact, public health orders, emergency orders, closures, and other things that impact all of us locally. So this is going to be, I think, one of the opportunities we have to support each other as branch partners by telling our story together, but understanding that we do have differences and supporting those differences and recognizing that it has had impacts differently on our different counties. So those are some of the thoughts that I've heard. I support those, and I just hope that through the process, we really respect and understand that there will be differences, and we need to understand those differences and be courteous and kind and respectful to each other, because this has been a challenging enough time. It isn't a time for us not to be working together.
Well said, Sherry. Thank you. Kim Turner, did you have something that you wanted to add?
Thanks, Rebecca, and really I appreciate the comments that have come before from David, Sherry, Rebecca, and Judge Conklin and others. But I think, one of the things that continues to plague us is, the uncertainty that's in front of us. And I know a number of court execs have spoken with me about their concerns about these paid leave programs, the emergency leave, the child care leave for employees that can't come in because they don't have school for their children, the employees who have to quarantine, those who actually pick up an infection. And so those, in addition to having true backlog of cases, we also have severe staffing resource shortages that are a result of this sort of rolling wave of infection that was getting better in California now appears to be, back on the rise. So I think we want to make sure that we capture, not just the hard number of how many, UDs we have in the pipeline and how many, civil cases and so forth, but we have to look further at what are the resources that we have to address those things. And we also need to look at the difference between true backlog and the very necessary in many instances service reductions that we're forced to take now as we have budget shortfalls in all of our budgets. I know some courts are already moving to reduce hours again. I mean, we've seen this movie before back in 2008 and 2009, where everyone was cutting their phone hours and their public window hours and so forth. So there are a whole bunch of sort of insidious costs that are harder to capture, but they're part of the narrative that I think we need to tell in order to really give a complete picture of the impacts of COVID-19 on the courts. There are also courts, as Sherry said, that did very unique things. Some courts have rented space, for example, off-site to do jury assembly. I mean, so that's a hard cost. They rented a fairgrounds space or a convention hall space, things like that that, are certainly not uniformly being done in every court, but they're being done on a court-by-court basis to best address the needs of that particular community. So we are, I think I just wanted to say that I appreciate each and every one of you. All of us have our individual challenges, but I think together we will tell an interesting and very textured story of what's happened in California with respect to public service delivery in the courts.
Kim, I'm sorry, Rebecca, go ahead.
Thank you. Thanks, Kim. I appreciate that. Chad, did you have something?
I do, thanks. And I think to a large extent, the discussions I've been having and the comments I've heard, they really dovetail quite nicely with what both Sherry and Kim have said. There's a recognition that this has been a very challenging budget year for all of us, for the whole state, and that we as a a branch, and particularly as a group of trial courts, you know, really came together quite well to, you know, deal with the methodology for apportioning the cuts and with the methodology that we've, you know, recommended to the council on the $50 million. And so I think that what no one wants to see now is a situation where the trial courts all feel like we're sort of pitted against one another. You know, for the remaining 25 million, I mean, it's as everyone has acknowledged, you know, COVID has hit all of us. It's hit us in different ways, but I'm quite certain there is not a trial court in the state that is not grappling with it in some way or another. And so, you know, I think there's a real sense out there that we don't want to be in a situation where we're, you know, fighting one another regarding the additional 25 million, because we're all affected by this. Along those lines, there's sort of a concept that some of us have kind of been kicking around, and I apologize because this is not a very artful way to put it, but a sort of concept where perhaps the amount that the courts potentially would have gotten under the model that was originally recommended, if those amounts could be, again, for lack of a better word, sort of held in trust for each court, right? So that if court A under the original model was potentially going to get 100,000, that 100,000 would then sort of be held in trust and then subject to, you know, whatever criteria the working group comes up with. But that way, there is a sense that okay, we're not, you know, no, we're not fighting each other for the money, right? That the money is kind of it's sort of frozen in place until we work out these criteria by which courts will demonstrate their backlog and what have you. So those are kind of the ideas that I've heard bandied about. So and I support both of those concepts.
Thank you, Chad. I do not see any other hands.
Judge Thompson has his hand up.
Judge Thompson?
Chad touched upon really part of what I was going to indicate. And then also, I think there's a lot of discussion about the beginning of the premise, which is addressing the backlog. But as I understood it, it wasn't just addressing the backlog. The funds are for also resuming normal operations. So it's really two. And there's an and conjunctive in there. It's not one or the other. It's what's being done to address both. And I think that needs to be considered when you're looking and doing the analysis on this. Because we're 58 courts in it, different positions throughout the state due to a lot of our local circumstances, it's what has a court been able to do to address the use of that money as was originally recommended, proposed.
Great. I'll just interject real quick. These are all, and I appreciate that. I think these all exemplify, and we're going to work out a way to have folks on this advisory committee communicate directly with those on the working group. These are all great suggestions. There's a lot of work ahead, a lot of definitions we have to work through, but I don't want anybody to think we're solving this problem today or that these comments made today are now going to be dismissed. These will go and be considered by the working group. But with that, I think I saw a hand up, and I apologize. Who was that?
I think it was somebody. Nancy.
Okay, Nancy, go ahead.
It's Nancy. Hi, thank you. Just to kind of add on to all of the other very good points that were made, and that is that I do think that we can be proud of the work that we have done on TCBAC to date and the professional way in which we provided a recommendation to the Judicial Council. And I do think that it is important to understand that we were entrusted by the Judicial Council in coming up with a new methodology and trying to determine how to collect the data. And that is a wonderful opportunity for us. And I think that as the working group is working through it, and I hope I can help in some small way, that we'll see that the need is even greater than the $50 million that was luckily given to us this year to attempt to allocate. So it's a good thing that we're doing this. And I know that TCBAC will do a great job of coming up with a recommendation for Judicial Council.
And I just want to add on to the comments that have already been shared, just a few other things that have been mentioned to me. You know, everybody is dealing with such a pressure cooker of issues right now. And so the thought that we approach this in a straightforward, simple manner as possible has been relayed a number of times. It's probably the common theme out there. And because people are just swamped right now. And so we definitely have heard that. I want to explain on page 31 through 34, there's some samples of tools we've used in the past for things. Those are included simply because those were suggestions by people to maybe use or modify as we saw fit if necessary going forward. That does not necessarily mean if we wind up with a working group that they have to use that, but I wanted to include that as suggestions from some of our peers. But I do think, you know, we've heard today, you know, about the narrative, and I think this is a unique opportunity to express how the branch has responded to this issue. And, you know, people are weary, and we do want to keep it simple. But I think that timing is important here because we've already started experiencing the cost and the limitation of our resources. And so if I don't want to cut anybody off, but if there's no other hands up, Judge Conklin, I would offer up a motion to establish a working group and further offer all these comments up for consideration by that work group.
And I'll second. This is Kim Turner.
So I just want to put, and I appreciate that it's been moved and seconded, but I want to make sure I understand and perhaps supplement the motion. So the motion, as I understand it, is that the chair and the vice chair, myself, along with the consultation with Rebecca, will consider volunteers for the immediate formulation of a working group. My guess is that every one of you is probably going to volunteer. So please don't be put off if we don't accept every one of you, because then it's not a working group. But I appreciate anybody who is interested in this and feels they have the time, and many of you may not. Please let Rebecca and I know if at all possible by Friday, because we're going to consult and get the working group put together as quickly as we can. And then that working group will, within the 4-part motion submitted back to us by the council, respond to the mandates of that motion. Our response will then come back as soon as practicable, yet effective, to tick back for then consultation with JBBC and ultimately recommendation to the council. Does that frame your motion, Rebecca?
That was exactly my motion, Jeff Conklin.
And Kim, did you say, was that your second?
Yes, it was.
Oh, wow. I'm learning as chair. Any further discussion? And again, this is not in any way to prevent people from chatting. It's just the opposite. Provide an opportunity for all of you to be heard as we move forward. Any further discussion on the motion? Do I hear somebody?
Yeah, this is John Wardlaw. Just briefly, with regard to what we've heard from the legislature, as was articulated in prior meetings, relative to the purpose of these funds, and that is, I think it's going to be really important for a focus on defining what is backlog, what is COVID-related backlog, and then where does that backlog exist throughout the state. That will be really important in order to develop a methodology for proper distribution of those funds. And with regard to the first $25 million that's going out this week, you know, it's important that courts understand really what is an appropriate use of those funds. So before expenditures are made, having that definition, I think, is important to get clarified for the courts as kind of qualifying for the use of that $25 million. So that I think is important. As we've heard from our friends at the legislature, again, purpose of the funds isn't so much for what was already expended by courts in the past fiscal year. As we, you know, obviously March was when COVID really started setting in. We started seeing closures, we started seeing slowdowns, but it's more intended for the constituents out there, people who are waiting to be served, and where are those hotspots out there? It might be throughout the entire court system, but that's what needs to be figured out for the next step as far as allocations are concerned. Again, I've not heard with regard to use of the funds, discussion about things have already been done by the courts. It was more intended for where are the long lines of individuals that still need to be served of those constituents.
That's much appreciated, John. And I think as David said, we recognize we're an advisory committee. We provide advice to the council. The council then accepts that advice or asks us to refine that advice, which is what we're going to do. And the most effective way that we can do that is with direct communication and with information so we to help us complete that task. So John, you'll be part of this, and we're going to ask you to come to the working group so we can directly communicate that type of information so the working group can work within that to get their task done. Because you're right, it does no good to come up with a recommendation that's not within the information that was provided. So I thank you so much for that. I assure you the working group is going to, and as you spoke, I was looking at the four-part motion from the council, and that's what our marching orders are going to be, that four-part motion, and then as is enhanced by comments that we receive from you, so we know as we move forward, we're being effective.
Happy to participate. Thank you, Judge.
Thanks so much. Okay, so I know we've all, and I don't mean to stifle conversation, it's almost 1:30. Again, emphasizing that the whole purpose of the working group is to enhance and to encourage these types of comments. The motion's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion on the motion as it exists today? I hear none. I typically just simply ask for a roll call of any opposed, but I'm going to ask it the opposite here because I want to make sure everybody has a chance to be heard. So I know it's difficult in a Zoom meeting, but I would ask all in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed, please say nay. And any abstention? Thank you so much. So I don't need to deem it unanimously approved. The votes establish that. The motion has been made, seconded, and approved. Thank you all so much, folks. To say this is an unprecedented time is disrespectful to the work you're doing and to the impact that everybody is feeling. So I so appreciate it. We're getting through. Don't ask me how, but we're getting through thanks to the good work of all of you. I so appreciate and I hope it's not inappropriate to say this, but when the chief issued your order stating that everybody's here for another year, it made me smile. So I'm glad every one of you is with us for another year. A few of you might be trying to retire out of this. If I could prevent that, I would. But I recognize that need as well. I'll close with this. I try to keep track of quotes that I think are most appropriate and perhaps sort of give us a little bit to smile about. And the two, I think, most effective quotes of the day, not in disrespect to anybody, were, "This has been a weird year," from Mike Planet, and from Kim, "This is a new era for fiscal austerity." I think that sort of puts it in context. So thank you all so much. We'll be in touch immediately. Rebecca and I, please, again, just to repeat, if you are interested, could you please notify us by close of business on Friday, August 14th? And it won't take us more than over the weekend or a few days after that to get the group together. If you're not included in the working group, it means nothing at all except for the fact that we just had to make some decisions and move forward quickly. So thank you all so much. Anything for the good of the order? Anything, Brandy, that I've left out?
No, thank you, Judge. That covers everything.
And I'll conclude it by saying, please, as best possible, folks, remain healthy. Thank you all so much. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.